So it is 5 o'clock on Tuesdays. You are listening to KDVS 90.3. And it is time now, as it always is, on Tuesdays at 5 o'clock for office hour. Before we begin office hour, I just want to remind all of our listeners today that the views that are presented on the show may not be the views of KDVS of the University of California, or the KDVS sponsors. So, here it is, 5 o'clock Tuesday, Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, ready to go out as we do on this public affairs show every Tuesdays at 5 and knock on someone's door and find out something that people are thinking about. What are they doing? What's the research? What are the ideas? What are the headaches of research that they're going to sleep with at night? And what do they want to share with us about their work? So here, you can hear me knocking. We're knocking on the door. And I'm very excited today to be knocking on the door of not only really a, you know, world-renowned scholar, but also a friend. And that is Joan Cadden from the History Department. So welcome, Joan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Right. So Joan is going to lead us into, I think, some really fascinating topics that help us understand the modern world by going back and looking at the medieval period. Something I think many of us sort of have mysteriously heard about, but we don't know a lot about whatever those dark ages were, right? On women, sexuality, gender, all kinds of great topics, philosophy. But as always, before we begin to look at her particular research, we always start with the same question here on Office Hour. We're interested in how people become situated in their life area of research. How is it that someone picks the medieval period to decide they're going to spend their life on it? And you're working in particular in the papers we're going to be talking today often about Spain, so late medieval Europe. So how did it come? How did you come to be a scholar of late medieval Europe, Joan?
Well, I think the first thing that brought me to the Middle Ages was actually the art and music of the Middle Ages. I grew up in New York City in the 1950s, and the New York Metropolitan Museum has a fantastic branch up on a hill, on a cliff in Upper Manhattan called the Cloisters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a museum that has collected, actually, stone by stone, entire parts of medieval monasteries from the 12th and 13th centuries from Spain and France, and placed in it collections of medieval art, tomb art, and cases that held relics and tapestries that decorated palaces. And it's situated, as I said, on a cliff. It overlooks the Hudson River. And as a kid, I went there, for example, on a weekday afternoon in the middle of winter when the wind was blowing and the river was gray. And I had a sense of drama and strangeness about these works of art that were so, from our point of view, unrealistic. They're very formal. The figures are very awkward. And also often representing biblical stories that I wasn't familiar with. I grew up in the Jewish tradition, and so the dominance of Christianity in the Middle Ages made it an exotic place for me. I loved the art. I loved the strange non-melodic music. I think it appealed to my adolescent self, so that's how I fell into the Middle Ages. But I didn't mean to be a medievalist. When at the age of, 12 or 13, I figured out that I wasn't going to be a right fielder for the Brooklyn Dodgers, I had to find
something you had been thinking about?
Something I had been thinking about, yes. But I kind of knew by then that it was unrealistic. By that time, I was in love with science.
Mm.
And so I left the Middle Ages behind, intending to become a Nobel Prize-winning biochemist, actually.
Mm.
It was through science that I got into the history of science. And at first, for me, that was the story of how humankind marched from ignorance to knowledge. My view of that has changed somewhat since then, but I loved the whole picture, but I couldn't let go of the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to college, I found a way of synthesizing my enthusiasm about science and my enthusiasm about the Middle Ages by heading in the direction of thinking about how did people explain the natural world at a time when they didn't know what we know.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, their ideas were as strange to me as their art, and I loved it.
No, the cloisters is a very ethereal and unreal place. I've been there. I imagine that some of our listeners have been to the cloisters. It's such a famous museum in New York. And I understand what you're saying. It has big empty spaces that always seem very cold. You know, that's what I remember as being sort of the vastness of the world replicated in these large halls. And also, one word you didn't use, which I associate with the cloisters, is mythical. There's all these stories. I remember mostly they're unicorns and figures like that. So I imagine that, I don't know whether for you, it's interesting, you think of the medieval, you're interested in science, so you think of science. I think also just of the crazy mythological tales that we have from the late medieval period.
Yes, and the crazy mythological tales intersect with the way in which they viewed the natural world, because many of the things that they believed in, we don't believe in anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unicorns, perhaps not. That is, they were not as serious about unicorns as they were about some other monstrosities. But they did think that way out there in the East, perhaps as far east as China, there were all kinds of two-headed animals and half-human beings and strange beasts, and so the bestiary, the parade of animals like unicorns was part of the medieval story. I've just recently been thinking about werewolves, which have made a comeback.
Yes.
In the modern era, with the Twilight series and so forth. But
they were popular.
Werewolves were
popular in your period.
Yes,
so you're somewhat of a specialist on that. So terrific. So you then became interested in this period, which would be, we call late medieval, and also in the question of the history of science. So we'll throw ourselves into your first article, which does fit into the history of science, but also raises a lot of other interesting questions, because it's about three nuns who wrote and what we call the textbooks. I don't know what we call them exactly, a book at that time. But these would be highly educated Spanish nuns from the 15th century. And I was quite struck when I read this, because I've, you know, dabbled in history through many different periods a little bit, how highly educated these women were, the amount of power that these women were given, and the fact that they also wrote and published their texts in their own names. So maybe you want to start us off by just explaining a little bit to listeners, because I don't know if we all have a clear picture of 15th century women, nuns, what they were doing and how they came to be in this place where they were sort of authorities in these textual traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up a little bit and say that it was when I ran into feminism sometime in the 1970s that I and other scholars started asking the question, where are the women scientists? Mm. And there was a quick answer, of course, Marie Curie, but it stopped there. And we were either going to say, never mind, or we were going to say, we may be asking the question in the wrong way. And when, as a medievalist, I looked at the women who wrote texts of any kind in the period of the Middle Ages, I found that there were a few, not many, who were really very well educated in mm-hmm. the sciences. Some mm-hmm. of them have become famous. Hildegard of Bingen is one that people who are interested in health food and creation theology and in all kinds of
and
other
music
and music may have heard of. She was a 12th century abbess of a monastery, and she was very deeply and widely read in the natural sciences of her day and wrote books on the subject. Like Marie Curie, she's unusual. And so we looked, we as feminist scholars of the Middle Ages, looked for another way of getting at the question of women and science, and started to look at women authors in general, just literate women who were writing about this and that. It turns out that most literate women, not all by any means, were in monasteries, in convents, that is, they were nuns. And the reason for that was two things. One was that nuns were expected to observe the religious offices, which were written down, and so they needed to be trained in the religious offices. Another reason was that they needed to administer their houses, their households, even though often there was a male priest who came by to say Mass for them because they weren't permitted to say Mass for themselves, still the case in the Catholic Church. Still, they had to run their own affairs. And to get back to your specific question about who were these women, how come they were so educated and so forth, the answer is in part that although we think of nuns as being ordinary women who take vows of poverty, in the Middle Ages, nuns were often members of the aristocracy.
Yes.
Of noble families. Any noble or royal family was going to have some of their daughters go into convents where they would pray for the family and observe religious rituals and do honor to the family. These convents often were in possession of vast tracts of land because pious people would make donations in their wills. And the vast tracts of land had vast numbers of peasants on them and were expected to produce soldiers, for example, for kings when kings were raising armies. So in fact, the people who ran, the women who ran these convents were people of wealth and status and political power and even sometimes of military consequence. Even though they were doing so from within a convent.
And on top of all of this that they're already doing, as you say, running a small city, they also seem to have time and energy or opportunity to read a lot of literature and then to write, which is in itself somewhat of a time-consuming activity as well. And it's clear from this that these examples, and we're going to look now at three of these, that these were all what we would consider upper class women who might have married into royalty, but instead, I don't know if you can, is there a reason why one daughter gets married into royalty and the next one gets sent, you know, goes off and becomes a highly educated, literate nun who writes, you know, tractates on theology. I mean, how did that get divvied up? Can you tell from the material they left behind?
We have very little biographical information about women from, or men for that matter, from that period, unless they make it into the chronicles for spectacular positive or negative reasons. But you can sometimes tell. Sometimes it's a coincidence of age and family organization. So if a noble family has the opportunity to marry a daughter off to a member of the royal house, the question would be which daughter is of the appropriate age. But it had clearly had to do with vocation. Hildegard of Bingen, whom I mentioned before, was educated by nuns in a convent before she became a nun herself. She was at a school in a convent, and she had visions, religious visions, very early. She was clearly going to become a nun. Mm-hmm. One of the women who figures in the article you're referring to, Teresa of Cartagena, was growing deaf when she was an adolescent, and so she was not a good marriage prospect.
No, that's a problem.
And
that would
so
be a problem.
She was the right one to go into the convent. And another one of the people I've written, the women I've written about, was in the convent because although she had very powerful relatives and was the granddaughter of a Spanish king, of a Castilian king, she belonged to the wrong branch of the family, and the branch of the family that was in power didn't want her branch of the family to have any kids.
Mm-hmm. So,
she was sent to the convent, and her brother was made a bishop.
So he wouldn't.
He was a person of great status and power, and she was the abbess, the mother superior of a convent. They were both of very high status and greatly honored, and continued to exercise power during their lives. But they didn't have
children
to compete with the,
which made their relatives very happy. So we have this picture then of these upper class families divvying up their children and the different social roles. Before we go to look at the three particular cases, which are really, really interesting, I just wanted to ask you whether you think there's a lot of more cases like this. I know I was also growing up with the feminist movement, and people went back and looked at the late antique and the classical material. And I think it's been really well combed over for any interesting thing that can be found that includes something about a woman, mm-hmm. you know, because I think people wanted to find whatever they could. And I'm curious if, you know, one of our listeners ended up a student wanting to go off and do the same kind of work that you were interested in, became a medieval historian, would you tell them that there's likely to be a lot more material like this that has not really been analyzed? Are there texts written by women that are hidden in some libraries in manuscript form, waiting for the next generation of medieval historians coming to find them? Or do you think your generation has done a pretty good job of sort of at least surveying for us what are the sources that are out there?
There are fantastic opportunities, and in some ways more opportunities because of my generation. So the first thing is that although some works by some women in the Middle Ages have in fact been recognized, they've been combed over in one respect or another, one can always approach them with new questions. Mm-hmm. So the women I'm speaking of are not obscure women to historians of Spanish women or to historians of the 15th century. But nobody asked the question, what did they know about the sciences? What did they know about medicine? So one can always bring new questions to well-known texts. But the other thing is that there are an enormous amount of works, most of them in manuscripts, some in a single manuscript, some in several manuscripts, scattered all over Europe and in some cases even in North American libraries, that my generation of scholars has been working hard to identify, but nobody has been through them in detail. Nobody has been able to, because there are so many of them, nobody's been able to finish them off as with respect to the possibilities they offer for understanding the lives and minds of women. There's a difficulty with the project, which is that when you're speaking about texts produced by women, you're necessarily speaking of a very small minority of elite women.
Yes.
And there are other questions that we have to ask about the lives of ordinary women. But there is a tremendous amount of fun to be had with these manuscripts. In fact, I'd love at some point as we move on to talk about what it's like to work with manuscripts. But this particular project with the Spanish nuns I did from printed mm-hmm. works. I didn't have to use
because these are women, as you're already saying, who are already part of the historical record. So this is not you going and finding in some, I imagine you off in some romantic corner of some European library, finding something that you with a woman's name at the bottom, that authored by some woman that nobody had ever studied before. So we will come back to that.
Yeah, these are let me say just how unobscure these women are. So. Excuse me. One of them, Costanza de Castilla, or Constance of Castile, who was a member of a royal line. Her works, her devotional works, her religious works have been printed and so forth. And after I retired from teaching, I went and lived in Spain for a year just for the heck of it. I lived in Madrid, and I went to the Madrid Archaeological Museum, and there was a special exhibit of their finest treasures. And among their finest treasures was the tomb of Constanza de Castilla. Mm. And there she is laid out. If you've been to the cloisters, as you said you have in New York, you know that medieval tombs often have a sculpture of the person who's in the sarcophagus, and the sculpture is lying down dead on the top of the sarcophagus, carved in marble. And there was Constanza of Castilla. And unlike many royal burials where you see the person's hands together in prayer, her hands were holding a little book.
Because that's how she was known.
Okay,
so we've got our first woman, and you're saying she was well known and treasured up till today. So Constanza of Castilla. So you say that she was she wrote a single work that was written for other aristocratic nuns. So she was writing for nuns in her own household, and she wrote it towards the end of her life, but she must have been studying and reading throughout her whole life. And then at the end of her life, she writes a compilation that you said it's in Latin and Castilian of a biblical, liturgical, and personal elements. Now, I'm not exactly sure. Can you translate that? What does that mean? Biblical, liturgical, and personal elements. I assume you mean that at the end of her life, she put together citations, a text that citations from the Bible?
Well, there are some citations from the Bible, and they would have been readings that she thought were appropriate for her nuns to go over, probably reading out loud to each other. Mm. So it was really a kind of a miscellaneous collection of pious thoughts, and some of the pious thoughts were passages from the Bible, and some were liturgical, meaning they were prescribed prayers from the Catholic tradition that she had chosen, that she thought were particularly appropriate for her nuns or for a particular day of the year. Mm-hmm. And then the personal were devotional texts, prayers really, that she herself composed in the manner of the kinds of prayers that she had been hearing and reading all of her life. In some ways, it's a pretty ordinary bunch of stuff. It's not that interesting.
She didn't sit down and invent a new form of a novel or something like that. Well, why do you think she did this? You said it's towards the end of her life. Was this something that an educated woman in the 15th century would do as a sort of a way of leaving a legacy? She wanted to leave a text, maybe in competition to men who left texts? Or why do you think she did this?
I think probably she, unlike one of the other women we'll speak about, didn't have a notion of a legacy so much as just that she was caring for her flock, so to speak.
There's things for you to read.
Here are some things for you to read. And probably these had been things that she had been working on or thinking about and gathering together. I say that because her legacy, insofar as it exists, was administrative. It was political. She was connected with people outside of the monastery and so forth. And I don't think she regarded as her writing as central to her identity, if we could say that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The other two women, I think, did.
They did. So she says, here I am running this the nunnery and all of these other stuff. This is what we do. We put together, this is my personal collection for my favorite nuns. But you do, as you say, you were looking at it in terms of history of science, and your sort of conclusion of this is that she doesn't seem particularly interested in what we would call science, and there doesn't appear to be an influence on her life or on her reading or on what she's trying to say in this book very much. Would that be right?
Yeah, and so in some ways she's probably more typical than the other women I deal with, but I wanted to include her because she uses some vocabulary of the scientific tradition in the same way that we today, for example, can talk about somebody having an inferiority complex or this or that complex without having read Sigmund Freud. That we just, it's in the air and you use some of the vocabulary. So that's one level at which women of a certain educational level were familiar with the scientific traditions of their time. It's a trivial level, but it's not unusual to find that kind of thing where they use scientific vocabulary in a casual and non-technical way.
It's a sign that she's well-educated.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think everybody will be struck by the range of this. Even though she was what we think of as being cloistered, she actually had a well-educated, she had many ties, as you say, outside of the cloister. She put together this book. It seems to have been a bestseller of types and passed on, and she's remembered as a literary figure then all that time later. So we're going to compare her then with two other women that you write about to get a sense of the range of what it was like to be a medieval woman nun. Isabel, the next one you talk about, and you mentioned that she was an illegitimate daughter of royalty, but that didn't seem to stop her. She is given she's allotted to the role of going to the nunnery and works her way. I assume she was a fairly powerful also nun. And she writes A Life of Christ, which is a literary, you describe it, I think this is quite interesting. It's a literary tour de force running about 1,000 pages in the modern edition. So that's quite a task.
It is just incredible. And what it is not a life of Christ, but a life of Christ's, of Jesus's mother, Mary. And that is, in some ways, the first level of originality and what one might say nerve of the work that she wrote, aside from the fact that it's so long. It's reconceptualizing the basic Christian texts, which is to say the Gospels that tell the story of Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's reconceptualizing them to tell the story of Mary. This is something that's been done recently in modern feminist literature. There was a bestseller recently about the witch Circe, who was a female figure in Homer's Odyssey. So take an old story and rewrite it from the point of view of the women, something that modern feminists did. I'm not going to call her a feminist because I think the word is a modern word, but the notion that you would take the basic Christian story, the basic Christian narrative, and retell it from not the point of view of the central figure, Jesus, but from the point of view of his mother was quite an extraordinary thing to do.
It is. It's amazing to think about that in the 15th century. And how do you explain it? Do you see that? Is that, well, if if women become educated, as these upper class women do, and they end up having both the leisure and the opportunity to read a lot and to write a 1,000-page book, that they're going to look for their women's versions of the stories that are passed on to them?
I think they are going to look for women's versions of the stories, and I think that's one of the reasons why her work was widely received and was one of the first works printed in Spain, was because people wanted those stories. But I also think that she was looking to establish the authority of women in a certain way. And to say women have a model for being religiously authentic. Women have a model for being spiritual leaders. Women have a model for having deep wisdom. Women have the right to do these things. She certainly never would have used the language of rights, but she is being very clever about establishing her authority as a writer, her ability to assert herself as a writer and as a religious leader by choosing Mary as her subject and talking about the role that Mary played, the central role that Mary played in the evolution of Christianity.
As a form of self-justification for our own life as well. Well, great. We want to talk about a third nun, and then we're going to move over and talk about some issues of sexuality, which I think prefigure modern discussions about sexuality. But we have reached the end of the first segment of Office Hour today. So stay with us, and we will be back after a few service announcements to talk more with Joan Cadden about medieval history. So we are back for the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we're talking about the really quite unbelievable world of 15th century women nuns who found time and energy to write a 1,000-page document on called The Life of Christ, but really the life of talking about Mary. And we're going to turn now to the third and final woman in this particular article of Joan, because I think the third woman is in many ways the most interesting. And this is Teresa of Cartagena. Cartagena, right, who was a conversa. That meant that her family had been Jewish fairly recently. Her father was Jewish.
Grandfather
was Jewish. And she goes the same path in life. She becomes a nun. She lives in the nunnery. But she manages to write quite a bit. Here, her first work you describe as Grove of the Infirm. It's quite an evocative title. An extended meditation on the meaning of illness in its literal and symbolic senses. So Teresa wrote about this partly because she, in fact, had become deaf, as you say, due to a disease.
Yeah, so she was apparently a hearing person when she was born and became gradually deaf, and she discusses that. And when she joined the convent, she could still hear a little bit and then lost her hearing completely, and she talks about that. The work, The Grove of the Infirm, and her later work is, like the work of the other two nuns, a work of Christian devotion. Mm. But it's a very personal meditation on the trials of mortal life. And it's expressed over and over again in terms of her own illness and the lessons that she's learned from her own illness about medicine and the body, and also about spirituality and what she calls, and the other nuns call, the divine physician, that is to say, Christ, who is the healer of souls. She is the person, partly because of the tradition that she was raised in, which was not a royal tradition, unlike the others, but a tradition of learning and literacy, and partly because of her own inclinations, somebody who knew a great deal more than the others did about the natural world as it was understood by her contemporaries. And so she integrates that into her devotional works, her religious works, partly as a metaphor for spiritual health. She uses bodily health as a metaphor for spiritual health, and partly as a way of talking about the trials and tribulations of life, and her, in particular, her life, that so often involved disease and suffering and so forth. And it's in that context that she uses, in very elaborate terms, sometimes in very technical terms, the language and concepts of the science of her day. And so she's the one of the three nuns who is what we might call most expert in that universe of
vocabulary. So she's clearly read a lot of medicinal texts. She's read a lot of philosophical texts. She integrates that language into trying to describe and make sense of her own life. How would you characterize, for those of us who've not read The Grove of the Infirm, what is she saying about the role of illness? And because she clearly wasn't healed, she remained deaf. So what would she say was the role of Christ the physician?
Well, the major plot, so to speak, of this meditation or devotional work is that it's a good idea to turn away from the world of the body and bodily suffering and bodily illness to the realm of spirituality, that mm-hmm. that's where one is going to find healing and success and so forth.
And it did for
but,
her.
And it apparently did for her. But she also thinks of the realm of spirituality in medical terms, that people who are embroiled in sin are like people who are sick. And then they need some sort of remedy. And sometimes the remedy will need to be harsh. And sometimes the remedy will need to be long. And sometimes the remedy will need to be gentle. Sometimes the soul needs to be nourished. Sometimes the soul needs to be cauterized.
Right. So you're getting more and more.
So you
the
get
language
this
is
language.
Getting more and more. Yes, yeah. You mentioned the idea of a curative syrup, that you use spirituality can be a curative syrup, which is mm-hmm. presumably a sort of medicinal term.
Yeah, well, something that you would get at an apothecary. You might get a salve or a syrup or a... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in this case, are you sort of saying that, well, women very much reflected their particular sort of microclimate, and her microclimate was a lot of men who read and talked about these kinds of terms and read these books, because she grew up in this sort of what could say intellectual academic family of the late medieval. So she just sort of absorbed it and then used that. And that was the difference between her and the other nuns who didn't use this medicinal material as much.
Yeah, I think she used it integrally because she was so well acquainted with it, whereas mm-hmm. the others used it a little bit ad hoc or just in passing.
Did you think she actually did anything medically? Do you have some idea that in addition to writing this, she actually functioned in some ways, what we would call a medical figure, a doctor yeah. of some form? Or does that women would only use this sort of language in their, you know, to write in their texts, but she wasn't actually out there trying to do medicine?
She fairly clearly did not. She talks about what doctors did to her or didn't or failed to do to her, but she didn't. Now, we know of other women who practice medicine within the context of a monastery or a convent and also outside. Hildegard of Bingen did indeed practice medicine within the convent. She was the infirmary doctor, so to speak. And there were many healthcare practitioners in the environment in which these 15th century nuns were working who were women, some of whom were famous and we know their names, many of whom were not named in the archives, but turn up in various stories and documents about other subjects. Mm-hmm. So it's not that women didn't practice medicine, but these women didn't. They were thinking of medicine and science as a form of knowledge, not as a form of practice.
Well, is it then sort of a division that the other women were too busy, they would be out there doing the healing and they didn't write? I'm sure there must have been male figures who did both, but do we find a kind of bifurcation in the women's tradition that some of the women sort of wrote these sort of, you know, philosophical or, as you say, really for liturgical, spiritual kinds of texts, and other women were out there just trying to help people with herbs and medicine and everything they knew about?
Yeah, most healthcare practitioners didn't write, whether
right.
they were men or women,
right.
as is the case today. It is true that very few women who practice medicine put anything down on parchment. There are a couple of notable exceptions. One is called Trotta of Salerno, whose works have come down to us, and other women are mentioned whose work we don't have, but are mentioned as having written. So there are a few of them, but in general, women's writing production is about devotional issues.
Exactly.
And medical texts are in general written by men.
Right. So if we turn next to one of your pieces about exactly that area of medical texts, we're going to turn from these, I feel like, I want to say goodbye to these three amazing women. And we're going to turn to these late medieval texts on medicine were, in fact, written by men. And they're part of your book, which is quite striking. Nothing Natural is Shameful is the title. Sodomy and Science in Late Medieval Europe. So to tell us about the way in which natural philosophy was incorporated in medicine to try to help people figure out what was natural. Now, you told me that in working on this material, you did a lot of manuscript work, working on this book. Mm-hmm. It meant going in deep into the world of manuscripts and manuscript surveying.
Yeah. So I got to the subject of what we might call the relationship of science and homosexuality through an earlier book that I did about medieval scientific ideas about male and female, about gender and sex difference. And that raised the question of sexuality. And I found a text that actually discussed in what we might call scientific terms, or more technically natural philosophical terms, because science as we know it didn't exist then. So I use the phrase natural philosophy. I found a text that described in naturalistic terms why some men like to have sex with other men.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought, number one, that's amazing and fantastic and fascinating. And I wrote an article about it, which I gave to you. And then I thought, but it's just one text, and it's just one passage in one text, and that's the end of it. But I got the idea that I could track down the different manuscripts of this one text. So it was written in the around 1300 by a physician who was also a philosopher from northern Italy, who had worked in Paris for a while. We knew his name, and he was very famous for another work that he had written. And so it occurred to me that this work that I had read in a printed edition from the 16th century might exist in manuscripts, and I could go and look at what the manuscripts looked like. And what I found was that the manuscripts were all full of commentaries and little marginal notes and erasures and so forth in this very brief text that talked about why some men like to have sex with men. The text itself gave multiple explanations. Some men like it because they were born that way. Some men like it because they had a pleasant experience and thought they would do it again. Some men like it because, well, the stars, the astrological causes.
Mm-hmm.
But as I looked at the manuscripts, I saw the contemporaries of this text, the people in the early 14th century, contending with the fact that they were face to face with a naturalistic explanation of something that they all believed was sinful and terrible and dreadful.
Well, it's kind of amazing the text survived. I mean, in some ways, you wonder why they didn't just destroy the text.
Well, the text survived because it was embedded in another text. It was a chapter in a book, mm-hmm. and the book as a whole was fine. But sometimes it didn't survive. There is a copy of a version of this this treatise that just leaves out the chapter.
Mm.
And there are several copies that include the chapter, but have marginal annotations saying things like, this is terrible.
Don't read this chapter.
This is shameful, it says.
Well, how did this guy, this is the Peter, right?
Peter of Abano, yes.
Peter of Abano. So now our listeners will have a very, very highbrow name to drop. Peter of Abano. He's writing in the 14th century, right?
Yeah, he finished the work in 1308 or something.
So this is early 1308.
Yeah.
So Peter of Abano in 1308 writing about this question of natural philosophy, and as we call it, what natural explanations for why men like to have sex with men. Where did this guy come from? I mean, how do you see him? Was it that an extension of his philosophy? Did he develop a natural philosophy first and then extend it to sexuality? And that's why he came to this conclusion. Do you have any idea what his thought process was?
Yeah, we have some idea. First of all, he's trained in natural philosophy, or what we might call science, and he's an expert on medical questions. And he's very interested in the disagreements among medical authorities. So his most famous book that was copied everywhere and quoted by everyone was the book that juxtaposed differing views of medical issues by different ancient authorities. Mm-hmm. So Galen thought this and Hippocrates thought that, and Aristotle thought something else. So he was very interested in intellectual conflict.
Yes.
So we know that was his mode, and he's highly educated in all of these ancient and contemporary texts. Then the other way we know he came to it is that he was writing a commentary, which was very common intellectual activity,
yes,
on a work by Aristotle. And Aristotle was greatly revered, and he was writing a commentary on a curious work of Aristotle called The Problems. And The Problems had lots of different, was a series of questions, and each question contained a couple of possible answers. Why do newly plastered rooms echo? And then, you know, well, one reason might be this and another reason might be that. And so he's going through all of the things that Aristotle talked about. And Aristotle talked about a number of questions having to do with sex.
Absolutely.
Because as part of the natural world and full of natural curiosities, Aristotle asked the question, why is it hard to have sex underwater? And then he discussed, you know, well, it could be
for this reason. In case anybody's wondering about it, yes, you can run out and get your Aristotle.
Yeah. So it's quite an amusing text. And within that context, Aristotle says, why do some men like to have sex with other men? And Aristotle, he doesn't answer the question. He says, is it because of their nature, or is it because of a habit, or is it for some other reason? And Aristotle gives suggestions about how one might explain these sexual inclinations from different perspectives, but he doesn't decide the question. So Peter of Abano is going through this work, just discussing all of the things that Aristotle discusses. And when he gets to the stuff about sex, he comments on the stuff about sex.
And I have to do that part too.
Right, I got to do that too. Aristotle did it, I can do it. And so that's how he came to say it. He probably would not have chosen it on his own.
Right, but then when he does say something, he sticks with his idea, it seems with his idea about, he has a very strong idea about how nature works. So that compels him to the argument that he's going to make, which is that he's going to say it's natural and therefore it's not shameful.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of how you would see him sort of coming to the conclusion that there's a natural explanation for why men like to have sex with men?
Yes, exactly. And the phrase "nothing natural is shameful" comes from somebody who summarized Peter's work, and he doesn't use that phrase, but uh-huh. It's quite clear. He works very hard. He says, well, from a psychological point of view, you know, if you have an experience when you're young and it actually feels good to you, then you will remember it. And he actually goes into the technical, for his day, psychological processes of memory and recollection and what we might call reinforcement and so forth. And then he has an anatomical explanation about where the passageways of the semen go in various bodies, various male bodies, and how they accumulate in various places and the process of ejaculation. And so he's talking in quite concrete terms and gives these explanations without apology. Mm-hmm. People who read his books made apologies in the margins, but he didn't.
Do you think that this piece of his had any effect other than annoying people so that they scribbled in the margins of his manuscript? I mean, you don't see a tradition. He's not cited as somebody who founds an idea and then embeds it into culture and then is copied over afterwards.
That's
from him.
Right.
So do we find any after, you know, effects of his piece?
No, I think he's not significant. His work is not significant, and his ideas on this specific topic are not significant because they were influential. For me, what's significant is that here is an intellectual living in a context in which the secular morality and the Christian, very powerful Christian authorities condemned unequivocally as unacceptable, as sinful, as even sometimes as inhuman, a particular sexual inclination. And yet there were people who were willing to entertain the idea that, in fact, some people just are this way. And because they are this way, they're part of a natural world that God created. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it's important to see the Middle Ages as a place where that idea could be entertained, because it's important for me as a contemporary advocate of human rights to say that it hasn't always only been one way or another way. There mm-hmm. was, even in the darkest time, the possibility of understanding. And mm-hmm. it's one of the things I like about the history of science, is to see people struggling against orthodoxies.
And so overturning it. Well, maybe for our listeners, it might also be helpful to tell us a little bit more about what it was about natural philosophy that also permitted him to make this argument. It seems that there's a very broad notion of natural being used here, and that might have just permitted him in a way that maybe psychological language might not have been as useful. In other words, the question is, was there something about, we know what the word natural means. We think about it. We think about it in the modern world. It's really good for selling shampoo, right? But I assume that natural philosophy meant something different in 1308 than what we would think natural meant in 2019.
Yeah, it did. And it included, by the way, it included psychology. Mm. Natural philosophy was a way of distinguishing the intellectual enterprise of understanding the world as we experience it and as we see it in a way that is distinct and in some ways shielded from theology. Hmm. That is to say, for example, in the universities, there was a distinction between the theological curriculum and the philosophical curriculum. The philosophical curriculum was mostly what we would call scientific. Mm-hmm. It was the study of the heavens. It was the study of material change. It was the study
of plants and animals
and so forth. And all of that was given its own domain and called natural philosophy. And in a way, although theology was regarded as higher than natural philosophy had its own territory in which to operate. And I think that's what Peter of Abano was doing. He was saying, I'm a physician. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a priest. I get to talk about my area of expertise. I wouldn't dare step on the toes of theology. I'm not going to comment on the Bible or anything like that. I'm just going to talk about the world as we know it, with our special tools of knowledge, natural philosophy, for this world. And I'm going to explain it as best I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
so fascinating. That's the significance of it.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that idea of separating out a discourse around the natural world that was separate from theology permitted, sort of opened up the possibility of reevaluating the way that things were evaluated, right, as being bad or sinful, that language permitted somebody in 1308 to have ideas that in some ways, in some circles, are still somewhat revolutionary in 2019.
Exactly.
You know, that's really quite impressive. So, well, thank you very much. I have a whole new view of 1308. And I'm thinking of these women writing a 1,000-page manuscript in the 15th century, these highly educated women. And who knows, maybe I'll page through it all, as you say, see the model of women authority in there. So I want to thank Joan Cadden very much for coming on Office Hour today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah. And as always, you can listen to this show over again on officehouruCDpodcast.com. I always say it twice, officehouruCDpodcast.com. And on that website, we also have all the other archive shows from previous versions of Office Hour, so you can listen to those as well. And we will be back next week. We'll knock on somebody else's door. And under the archive, there will be a link to Joan Cadden's website as well, so you can get some more information about the list of the literature if you want to read some of it. So I guess until next week, we'll just think about mind-expanding people writing wild and, as you say, you know, not orthodox, challenging orthodoxy in the 14th century. So we'll think about that. It's quite amazing. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.